But when Trevor prays, he doesn't even own a car. But if he did, he'd always be like next to the handicap spot. He's got a hotline to God. That's awesome. Anyway, and if I was inclined to that sort of shape of making requests of God, or seeing confirmation and, you know, all sorts of things, which this isn't my tendency. But if I was inclined that way, I would have felt like God dropped a neon sign out of the sky this morning that said, good call. You know, it's just time. So anyway, that's enough about that. Some of you guys know I grew up in the more northern part of Canada. I grew up with a family whose near history wasn't that far removed from pioneering. My grandparents on one side were first generation immigrants from Russia. On the other side were people who in terms of race and ancestry, quite a mixed bunch, but people who homesteaded in the prairies. And all that to say that there's a sort of this ethos in the family I grew up in of if you need something to happen, part of the way it happens is you just put your hands on it and you pour your life into it. You just do what you can to make it happen. That's how you live. And so a saying like God helps those who help themselves wouldn't have been necessarily part of the above the waterline expression at the dinner table, but it would have been all over the place below the waterline in my life and family. A robust and visible faith was part of that family life, that we would learn from the cradle that you pray about ordinary things. You don't necessarily expect a parking space. But go ahead and pray about it. If it matters to you, it matters to God, kind of a situation, right? Pray about everyday things. Pray about everything. It's all fair game. And God cares. That doesn't necessarily mean God is wandering around looking to rescue you from everyday things. A lot of those things you're responsible for. So get off your ass and do them. You know, that's your gig, right? That kind of a combination sort of feels like where the space I grew up in. And so this is still the tone of the emails I get from my mom, you know, about my dad. When he's kind of, it's like, you know, we're hoping, we're waiting, we're praying and waiting and hoping. And dad made a bed on the living room floor so he doesn't have to crawl as far to get to the bathroom because he's really supposed to stay face down. Okay? So that's, I mean, this is ordinary stuff, right? And this is life in my parents' home this week. There's a saying that comes from the coastal communities where, you know, when you're working, you're working in a boat. That's the answer to the question, if you believe in God, what do you do in a storm? And the sort of folk saying answer is you pray to God and row for shore, right? And I think that's that same idea in just another folkism kind of shape. It's interesting to me that when I look back on my life and family from that perspective, I think about those kinds of ideas and growing up with them. I think I was watching my family of origin do two things. One was live with a certain kind of tension, because there's a tension between those ideas of God as kind of this cosmic rescuer who just could reach us down and pluck us out of whatever sort of crazy situations we get ourselves into or that life brings, right? Because if God can do anything, and this is part of the blessing I pray for one of my kids every night, the God who can do anything is one of the phrases in that blessing. I want my kid to know that. I want them to believe that. But I know every time I pray that thing, every time I try to live that thing, I'm creating a dilemma. Right? If God can, will God? If God doesn't, why not? If God does, why? And we got a driver inside of us about questions like that is enormous and potent. Read somebody speculating about something completely different in the news, in the media this week, and touched on this question. It just almost as a little dog leg to what they were writing about why do bad things happen to good people, and then just commented alongside that, which leaves completely unaddressed the question of, you know, why do good things happen to bad people, right? But we wrestle with these dilemmas deeply and constantly. This is kind of how we're wired. And I felt like I was watching my family live with that dilemma the same way I sort of as a parent now. I visit that dilemma on my children, just by virtue of saying, I believe there's a God out there, I believe that God is good, I believe that God is powerful. Dilemma, right? And so there's that that I felt like was part of my story growing up. There's this sort of beacon of this good, powerful, can-do-anything God. And then there's this kind of pragmatic, pioneering acceptance of the nature of the world in which we live and move and have our being, and that it sometimes it's unjust and difficult and confounding, and sometimes it's Sisyphean. You push the rock up the hill and it rolls back down, and you get up the next day and you push the rock back up the hill again, and that's part of life here. And these two things, these two ideas, these two realities, let's call them, have to find a way to coexist if we're going to hold on to that view of the cosmos. Otherwise, we can philosophize and agonize and navel-gaze and ruminate as much as we wish, but at the end of the day, either we would live with a certain kind of tension that comes with these two ideas, both existing in our view of the cosmos, or we abandon one of them. We reshape the whole paradigm, right? Somebody just told me last night about a bumper sticker they'd seen this last week that said, I'm one epiphany short of a paradigm shift. I want that. I want that sticker. I want that shirt. Because that's sort of where we live, right? It's kind of like we just feel like we're right up against figuring it out sometimes. We have a moment of clarity, and then whatever, something happens, and there goes our moment of clarity, and we're back in the tension of it again. I'm illustrating the dilemma from contemporary circumstance, from my life and my life growing up and things around us every day. But I don't think there's anything contemporary about the dilemma. I think the dilemma is as old as conscious thought. I think the dilemma is as old as humanity going, what are we going to name the nameless one? What shape shall we give to our idea about God? God's the realm we don't see as readily, spirit. But that it's hard for us to shake loose the possibility that it's real. We just keep hanging on to that. It's as old as that. And as somebody that that cares about the biblical story and believes that it speaks truly to us, I don't feel like I'm surprised when I encounter the working out of this dilemma in really practical, storied ways in Scripture, because it's part of the deal. What pisses me off is when I encounter those kind of stories in Scripture and I hear people teach them like they're the last epiphany before the paradigm shift, and now it should just shift. Like the stories are supposed to contain a resolve of that question. Give me a break. If the stories contain the resolve of that question, why over the centuries have we just not been able to agree about the resolve and get on with our epiphany? Maybe the stories aren't meant to resolve the question. They're meant to illustrate the fact that it's in the question that God lives, that it's in this tension, it's in this wrestling with these things that seem like they're at odds with one another sometimes, that we are meant to live, that this is our world. So what I wanted to do this morning is two things. I want us to look briefly at a little portion of a biblical story that I think is about this kind of stuff and that pertains in some more direct ways to the precise season that we're in, even this morning, the season of actually dealing with space questions and space that has to do with gathering as people who are seeking God and for worship and with moving. So there's a bunch of those kind of themes that are part of this story that I want to look at. And I want us to take some time to just speak to one another about stories from this season at Frame, because it's been an interesting chapter. It's been a chapter that's been appended to and taken place in no small way in a certain location, in a certain space. In what in the story we will be looking at this morning could be a city. You know, it's just this is smaller, but it's been our place. And I think it's important for us to tell one another some of those stories in whatever form they come out for us this morning. And then we're gonna pack it up and we're gonna move spaces. And among other things, the space we're moving to has lights and heat. And on a morning like this, just those things at the bottom of the pyramid get released to appreciate, right? And so we can look forward to that. So the story is Nehemiah. And the book of Nehemiah is like a bookend to the book of Ezra. They're basically like one story. They cover about 100 years. It's a short time frame. The story takes place in kind of mid 500 to mid 400 BC. The Persians are basically rocking the world. They are the empire. And they are a large, potent empire. They are the Western world of the Eastern world at this point in history. They're it. They're the big dog. They have some enlightened approaches, I'm going to say. That's editorial. But I'm going to say they have some enlightened approaches to the way they deal with the nations they subjugate, the nations that they defeat. And one of the things that they do that I think is quite enlightened and that worked really well, so even pragmatically it looked wise, is that they gave the people they conquered not just freedom to practice their original religion, but they really encouraged them to practice it in a robust, vital way. Lots of subjugating empires don't do that. I would contend that the Western world in which we live doesn't do that. And I'm going to use one of my favorite negative illustrations. And you can call me out later. But anybody here remember what Bush said after 9/11 about how to get the nation feeling robust again? Broadly speaking, you remember the gist of this? Go to the mall. Go shopping. We have a religion in the West. We're not abashed about it. And we do not actually encourage people to live a different ideology robustly. Or we wouldn't say asinine things like that in the face of unbelievable, horrific tragedy. I have an opinion. Okay, so I'm not going to keep going down that path because I think I've illustrated well enough. The point I want to make is not that a particular world leader, you know, was or is an idiot. That's not what I'm trying to say, and I didn't say it. It's not on the podcast. What I'm trying to say is that we have a religion in the West, and it's called consumerism, and we don't encourage people to live something different than that. And maybe we should pay attention to just how well this worked. If what we're trying to do actually is get compliant citizens as opposed to engaged citizens, even there, even if that was our mission, which it's not supposed to be, even if it was, if we were so blithe as to admit such a thing, it might still be wiser to say, practice your religion robustly, with vigor. Israel, as a nation, never has, arguably, a healthier version of living out the story that they're called to live out than they have under the Persian Empire, as people who are defeated and not living under their own governance. And I think that's kind of interesting. It's complicated, but it's interesting. So, one of the things that's happened, of course, in this course of this war is that we're going to have to actually unpack our chairs. They're all piled up in the other room. There's a couple of chairs. There's four right up here in the spray zone. I can see three back there. Okay, so I didn't say this yet, so another little diversion, but thanks, everybody, for coming out this morning. I know, like, I just watched John come in, and his kids came in, like, 10 minutes ago going, so Dad can't come because, like, the key's frozen in the lock of the car. We chose to live here, right? Okay, anyway.
He came back. Yeah. There's free parking for, like, during the time, like, 2-hour time, like, downtown, because all the parking meters are...
Perfect. It's an electronic insurrection. Yeah. Okay, the climate's going to help us do what we need to do. Oh, dear. All right. Where was I? Israel is a nation. One of the things that happened under Persia when Judah actually was defeated in this military maneuver is that Jerusalem, their place, got turfed. Most of them were taken away from there and encouraged to practice their religion as not free people in another country, in another culture. But some of them stayed behind in Jerusalem. And where we pick up the story of Nehemiah, some folks have come from Jerusalem, from the ruins, the remnant, from this little group of people that are on the margins of not just empire, but in the ruins of a previous culture and people group. And they've come with a story about how things are going for those people and for the city. And the story that they've brought to tell is that it's all in shambles. And Nehemiah, who is a person who believes the story, a person who would have held that idea that God is who God has sort of been revealed to be at this point in the story, and calls the people to live out this unique, completely culturally identifiably different way of life in the midst of whatever culture they find themselves in, including cultures of captivity and subjugation. He would believe that, and yet he's serving as the cupbearer to a king that holds power over his own people. See how complex this is? But he still holds this ideal. Is he living with the tension of how does this work in the real world, do you think? I think so. So when these guys show up with a story about this remnant of people, the people of God, as the story kind of identifies that whole tribe at this point, and what their life is like and how in shambles it is, Nehemiah reacts to that, and then he responds to it. And there's something about the way he both reacts and responds that I think is a bit of a lesson for us in this season of our life as a community, specifically, and in this season of our life in the realm that let's just broadly call Christendom in the West. First thing that happened, first chapter. So he hears the report, and then we right away find out that the first thing he's willing to do about the story that he's heard is just be honest about it. And not just externally honest, but internally honest. Because the first thing he does is the text says he weeps. You don't weep about a news report unless you let it get to the affective part of your being. Unless you let it get down in there where we feel stuff. We're pretty good at information. We're kind of inundated at it. We've kind of had to gain some sort of skills about handling information overload, right? Just to survive in our culture. And so we've got information Teflon around our hearts. You know, slippery, hard stuff, right? The information kind of comes. Oh, look, another famine. Oh, look, another tsunami. Oh, look, another war-torn country. Oh, look, more starving children. What do you do with the flood of that? As a human being, you can't let it all into the affective part of yourself, or you'd just be a puddle. And I don't think Nehemiah let everything in either. And one of the reasons I would say that is because somehow, every day, he went into work happy. We find out later in the story. Because he shows up unhappy later in the story, and the king's kind of weirded out and says to him, "But this must be a sadness of the heart," he says to him, "because you've never been unhappy in my presence before." And I get that it can be rhetoric. But there's a theme in there, you know? So somehow, in this tension, right, Nehemiah's wrestling this down. But when he hears this story about the people who say they identify with one true God being in shambles, in disarray, he lets it get through the Teflon. He lets it get down into his gut, and he weeps. And then he thinks about it for a while. He's quiet. He doesn't act. And what he's doing, the text tells us, in that process, is he's praying. It's like a season. We don't really know. It's a few days, it seems like, from the story. I think that's a fascinating combination. I think it's illustrative of that same dilemma that we're talking about when we talk about God being good and able to do anything, and the way that we encounter life and the tension between those things. It's the same dilemma as God helps those who help themselves. It's pray to God and roll for shore. And if we could argue that there's an order to these things that is more right, putting pray at the front end of the maxim is it. Pray to God and roll for shore. As opposed to roll for shore until you can't row anymore and then start praying. You know, which, really? If we were going to ask for a show of hands about inclination, I'd have to be the first one to put up my hand and say, I think I've got the maxim backwards most days. I'm going to roll my butt off, and then when I just can't hold on to the oars anymore, I'm going to be like, God, where were you? It's like, well, you were rowing, you know. Anyway, so the first thing Nehemiah does is he prays and he waits, and he just kind of lets it perk. He listens before he speaks. And he listens to his heart, and he listens to his God. He does both those things. That's wise. And then he goes into the king, because it's wine-serving time, and that's his job. Not going to parse whether he's the one who has to taste the wine every day to see if it's poisoned or not. Anyway, every job has its hazards. So he goes in with the wine, and he's sad, and the king comments on that. And says, what's up? This must be a sadness of the heart. And so Nehemiah tells him the story. He says, my people in their city, it's in disarray. I want to go do something about it. I would like a leave of absence, letter of passage, some resources. So I want to go do something about this. But in that conversation, the same pattern occurs. Because when the king asks him what he wants, Nehemiah knows that culturally, he is now in dangerous territory. Because the king has initiated the conversation. He said, you go ahead and tell me what you want. But Nehemiah knows that he could have never initiated that conversation. It would have cost him his life. And he knows that how he handles this could still cost him his life. And so he answers in the ritualistic way, oh, king, live forever. You know, it's like, it just you can see him acknowledging the power imbalance in the situation. And then still being really clear about what he wants. And the text gives us this pithy little saying. It's in chapter 2, verse 4 and 5, where basically, if you read it in a parallel, in a paraphrase, what it says is Nehemiah basically muttered a prayer under his breath and answered the king and said what he wanted. So that same pray and act, right? It's the same pray to God, row for shore. Oh God, if this goes wrong, I'm dead. This is actually something probably of the nature of the prayer, right? Because this is literally what's going on. And then, having said that, this is what I understand to be a good course of action. This is what I think I should do. Will you help me do it? Because you could. When Nehemiah gets there, of course, it is a shambles. Walls torn down, and the wall's not just symbolic. The wall's literally a meaningful part of people being able to live in that place and be safe. And the task is enormous. It's daunting. It involves a lot of just plain flat-out work, labor. So Nehemiah goes on this famous little journey around the walls of the city on a donkey at night without telling anybody but this kind of select group of inside leaders. And then chapter 4, verse 14 says, after I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Them are the detractors. Them are the surrounding cultures in this case. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. And fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. We're not going to take the time to talk about a warrior culture and the evolving idea of a good God and the cultural shape of that this morning. It's almost irresistible to me, but I'm going to just let it be and say this is a good picture of this dilemma in this culture at this time. Remember the Lord, who's great and awesome. And by the way, your work in this setting is to fight for your brothers and your sons and your daughters and your wives and your homes. If you ever wonder, by the way, okay, I can't resist entirely. If you ever wonder, by the way, about the evolving idea of God in Scripture, this is as good a text as to chase down as any. Because honestly, in the cultural context, for a leader to say to people, the people of God, that God's understanding is that what we should do is go fight for, listen to this, your brothers, your sons, end of sentence, culturally speaking. All the valuable people have now been named. Right? But that's not where the sentence ends. And your daughters, and your wives, and your homes. So if you ever wonder if God's moving civilization somewhere in history, just stop at moments like this in our sacred text and pay attention, because there's no women sitting around this leadership table. Okay? Because why? Because they're cattle in this culture. That's why. They're property. Except that somehow enough of God's wisdom is already starting to filter down into this context to say, no. That's not how this works. That's all I'm going to say. Okay, so this tension, right, this original idea we started on, made a plan and then got on with it. And the context, though, the context for the courage to get on with the plan was remembering the character and nature of God. Remember God? Remember how that being is in the world? I know it's not clear right now because our homes are in shambles and our lives are in danger and the walls torn to bits and there's hardly any of us and there's a lot of them and should I keep going? We're in trouble. Remember God and the character and nature of God. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to start stacking up rocks. Yeah, right? Man, it's crazy. The people around him knew it was kind of crazy. And I mean, we won't go into how he broke it down, but the short version is everybody got an assignment. It's like this family takes care of that part of the wall. This business takes care of that part of the wall. These nobles take care of this part of the wall. And when the resistance gets too high for us to just build every day, we're going to wear our armor so people know we're serious about this, and we're going to just keep going. And if half of us have to stand guard so the other half can work, that's what we're going to do, because we're going to do this. Why are they so determined? Well, partly they're so determined because the space itself, the actual place, is sacred. It'd be easy to miss how filtered down into the minutiae of the story that is. We can kind of go, it's Jerusalem. It's the city on the hill. It's this iconic place. And of course it is that, right? But it's also your wives and your daughters and your homes. Zerubbabel's already been back and rebuilt the temple, by the way, in this story. So that's part of it too, right? But there's all these layers. And it's like the story is trying to say to us, when you work out this dilemma of what does a good God look like when we're trying to figure out what to do today, that there's not a layer of life that's left out of this. All right? There's not some part of what we do every day that is divorced from either the exciting, dynamic, pulling me forward part of this story, or from the tension of it, from the dilemma of it. This is actually meant to filter down into everything. So I just watched Colin come in, dressed like a working man's version of an Eskimo. Colin probably had to shovel snow out of a trailer this morning. I had to shovel snow out of a trailer this morning. I'm not telling you a hero story here. I'm telling you an ordinary story, okay? And what I'm trying to say is, and you know, John had to figure out how to get his truck to stop running. I don't know once he started. I'm not sure. I haven't heard the whole story yet. And everybody just kind of had to get their butt out of a warm bed and get here, and we could keep going. This is the stuff of life, right? This is what we do. This is piling up rocks in the wall. This is just putting the pieces together of life. This is our business here. So when we wrap this gathering up today and we go load things into trailers and we move it to a new location and we try to figure out how to set it up, it's the same job. Do you guys get this? There's no part of this that is meant to be disconnected from the big part of this. And the more we can either wrestle with that or have that filter down into our everyday, the more we can start to understand that although there are representative places, and that matters, so here's where we gather, here's where a bunch of this story happens, we're going to be an independent for an undetermined season, there are going to be things that happen there in that place too. That's part of the story, like Jerusalem being an iconic, sacred place is part of the story. But it's not more or less part of the story than, by the way, you also need to take care of your wives and your daughters and your kids and your home and your work. There's nothing that's meant to be left out. And we seem to have trouble with that. It's like we want to separate the bits. Why? Why would we do that? Well, partly because it's a way, I think, of reigning in the dilemma. If we can make the things that are about God, if we can confine them to an idea space or a literal physical space or certain moments of the day. Now I'm doing my devotions. What a absurd piece of language. Anyway, now I'm doing my devotions. You don't do devotions. Anyhow, sorry, another rabbit trail. So there's God. There's my God time, right? And we'll call it stuff like that. We use this kind of language. I'm not leaving myself out. We talk about God showing up because what? God wasn't here before. I mean, no, we're describing a unique experience when we use that language. But let's try harder for some better language. Because every time we do that shit, what we're doing is we're divorcing the sacred from everything else. And then we wonder why we feel like the world is bereft of the presence of God. We are doing it to us. God is not doing it to us. And so when we zip up our jackets today and we go load stuff and we take it to another space, and when we meet next week in that space, we're not meeting someplace where God is, because God isn't somewhere else. The both-and-ness of this is absolutely pervasive. And that's our dilemma. Partly we exaggerate the dilemma when we imagine that the question why about these things is actually one that is going to have a clear, satisfying answer in this life. Fire me next week, but this week I'm here to tell you it ain't going to happen. It never has in the history of humanity, and it's not going to be our turn. You know, our job is to live in that tension and to work this out in that tension, because that's where we're formed. All right. I had intended for this to be much briefer, but my goodness. Anyway, it's like somebody delivered a barrel of fine, refreshing beverage to my home and said, here's a thimble, have a little sip. Anyway, sometimes you just got to have a drink. So we've lived, I think, in ways that I love as a community, with some of these tensions. I know enough of some of your stories to know that you live as people with some of these kind of tensions in really engaged, intriguing, rich ways. It's one of the reasons it's such a delight to get to do what I get to do in this community, because of those stories and because of those wrestlings. I often come home from time with people in this community just really floored by the substance of the struggle. I, when I'm in the presence of that dilemma being wrestled with, I feel like I'm in the presence of exactly what we're made for, and it knocks me over every time. I love it. Not because it's easy or sweet necessarily, but because it's good. And so some of those things have been part of our season here, And I want us to take at least a few minutes, and this will just have the shape that we give it. But I'd love to hear from people in the community about experiences that, when you think back on the time we've been at Frame, when we've been in this space, and I said to somebody this morning, it's kind of funny, actually, we have now met, as of this morning, in every space on the shared space level of Frame. We didn't plan to do this, but I sort of felt like there's a certain poetry to this that I'm really enjoying and appreciating this morning. And anyway, all to say, memories, stories, things that have been part of this season of our life. I'd just love to hear some of that this morning. And then we're gonna sing a song or two together, and we're going to put our mittens on, and we're going to stack some rocks.